Well, it's Christmas Day, and this is the Limitless, the podcast between, which will be airing on Boxing Day. Happy all of that, holy days, as I like to call it. That's D-A-Z-E. Oh, I used the American Z. This is my conversation with David Constanza, Cosmic Clown of Art of Flying. You look a little bit like David Lynch, at least from this angle.
I do. I look at him. You're right.
Yeah. So, but you're all dressed up.
I am. I was. It's not a normal day for me, but I just came from another interview where a friend of mine was interviewing artists for a project that she's doing. So. But I actually dress up for work, so that's kind of what it is. Let's see.
So I was going to ask you about your experience of me and what you're familiar with and what you like. And so not that I want to talk about me the whole time. I definitely want to get to the album. But since you waved that book at me, that is a cue for that. Why that particular book? Why did you choose that out of everything?
I'm happy to judge books by their covers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I judge wine by the cover, and I judge book by the cover. And I saw the cover. I liked it. It turned out to be a little quicker of a read than I had expected. It's more of a essay. It felt like an essay and a real, like our conversation. So it's got the conversation going, which is what I wanted too, because I thought I shouldn't really contact you until I've read something. And then I grabbed that. It was good. And we had talked about your brother last time, because is he born in 1962?
Yeah.
Yeah, same as me. So not that that means much.
Well, it means something. Did he come up? It must have.
We talked about last time when I spoke to you a few years ago, and you said, I think I mentioned my birth date, and you said, "Oh yeah, that's the same as my brother." And I actually didn't even know who he was. I only knew, I found him through you. So,
right. So, and how did you like the book?
I liked it. The writing style wasn't what I expected. I wouldn't call it exactly conversational, but it was a little more condensed. Like, you called it a mythic narrative, and that's what it was.
Yeah.
I expected a little more of a country rolling ride, on sentences that it didn't have, but just from our few conversations and listening to your podcast.
Interesting.
And that's not a criticism. That's
I wouldn't know how to take that, but it's a very evocative way of speaking, a country rolling ride.
Right. In terms of the way, when I was in LA a couple of years ago and listened to a bunch of the Limitless podcasts, and I think your sentences, we've really digressed, but no, the sentences are longer. It was shorter. The sentences were very short. It was very like, you're kind of like chiseling. I think you were chiseling away at something that was, important to you to get done. And you're just kind of hacking away at it a little bit.
I understand what.
Not a good word in it.
I understand what you're saying now, because that's, that's an insight into the difference, not just between my writing and talking, but probably writing and talking in general. But certainly, yes, when I talk, I do tend to just keep talking until I get to where it is that I'm trying to get to, however long the sentence has to be. And that's quite an art, to actually make it grammatically correct, and punctuate it correctly and still end up with a full stop and still have it make sense. But it doesn't really matter that much, because you just keep going. Whereas with the book, I keep going back and I chisel and I edit and I try and reduce it to the elixir so that it's as concise as possible.
And so that's what it was. And it was great. I read it in one sitting. It was it had a cathartic, it was a cathartic experience that I enjoyed.
Oh, well, that is something then. So let's move over to you now then. You just spent 2 years making an album, although at least two songs of those were already
Yeah, well,
online.
right, the one you would have heard, Escort Mission, was the that was kind of the keystone of what made it take so long. I think it's even, I just said 2 years, it's probably closer to three. If we were, if I was to debate to date when Escort Mission came out, we mixed that and we felt like we had done something that was a little more lush and a little more polished and a little more like elongated. Like the country roll, you know, a little more spacious, and took the time, and then we ended up going through everything again and again to get everything to, that kind of dragged everything up to its level, even though I wouldn't say they all sound that way. But there were, at the beginning there were 23 songs, and it was going to be the usual, just me kind of hammering away, and then again leaving them kind of chiseled and kind of just like attack points. But we ended up pulling away to the ones that really wanted to be finished, and a much more finished kind of thing, which has been good. It feels some ways, a lot of ways, like an introduction to the as I send it out to the world. You know, an introduction again, like a starting over. There's a certain starting over, and there's two new members who are really part of making this album. They kind of came on board after Ann and I had started some of the sounds, and they went through everything with us as well, the drummer and the guitar player, Kevin and Max.
And did you start out, at what point did you decide you were making an album?
Yeah, that's it. I know, that's interesting. I think because I, for me, I'm sitting in my little study, and that's where the mixing board was, and I would just make sounds and keep making and making and making. I think at one point I wanted to make a cassette, a 90-minute cassette full of songs, the kind that really tests the listener's patience. Those kind, the ones we've come to love sometimes. Where really, where it really has things that are really gratuitous and extended, and so I worked on a lot of those, and everyone was a good sport, and they joined in on a lot of those songs. But as it came, narrowed it down. You know, and again, as we did Escort Mission, we're like, we can actually do something like this, and not knowing exactly what that was, but we
So
could do.
there was something about Escort Mission, the song
Yeah, Escort Mission dragged us into another place.
that
Yeah, that song, I had put that song out by itself as kind of a single, and it really called it, and then it ended up being the title of the album, which wasn't even my choice. That was Anne's choice.
So it's as though that song had a sort of secret life that demanded a context, that you build this
Exactly.
context that it could live in, or a nest even for it to live
Yeah, exactly. The whole thing had a bit of a secret life, and it kept pulling. You know, the title changed. It put in the, you know, the context, and making it shorter and making it more dense.
Right.
You kind of just, yeah.
So let's talk about the title, and I was just because I compared you to David Lynch, I'm now, or because I saw that similarity, I'm now going to be very sensitive to what many artists do feel, and David Lynch specifically feels, is he doesn't like to interpret what he does. So if you're like that, you're just going to have to say so. But what does Escort Mission? What's the significance of that? Is there more you can say about it, or does it just have to remain enigmatic?
Yeah, I don't like to, I wouldn't say I don't like to interpret what I do. I would say I'm not capable of interpreting. You know, I don't have that skill set.
Oh, I think that came up in our last conversation as well,
Yeah,
didn't it?
I used to have friends that had that skill set, and I let them do it. And if you look at the cover, it ended up three pairs of guys kind of dancing in a river. I don't know if you got artwork as well.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, and so, and I don't even know what Escort Mission means. It's actually Anne's song, and
Okay, so
you know
you
what I mean,
said
I don't, it's don't totally know what it. I think it's a mission when people go with together or something. I don't know. I was content to just, you know, not. I didn't prepare for this conversation.
And you didn't ask her what it meant.
No, I didn't.
Yeah. So, and that was.
And it's her song, and it was really, yeah, the key to the whole thing. So.
Right.
Happy to name it, you know, like have it signify that much. So.
Well, it isn't a name that demands interpreting or anything like that. It's only now that we're having this conversation that it occurred to me to think, what does that mean? And I think that that's part that has to do with it, with naming in a way that's very evocative, and just the sound and the juxtaposition of the words seems to work. And then it's more right brain, right? It's more musical.
I like to name it and move on. You know, not necessarily. I'm content to name it if I like. Like I said, I judge the book by the cover. You know, the name, the sound. I'm more harmonic in the sound and stuff. And I feel like the wormhole of definition, you know, is expansive. I mean, I'll play along sometimes. But again, I'm not that skilled at it. I'm not. It's not my skill set.
Or your predilection.
Yeah, right. If you want to name it that one too. I was, but I did, you know, gather the songs, and I did kind of write most of them, and I did kind of, definitely kind of shepherded this whole thing. You know, let's get together, let's keep going, and then we finally got to the end, and everyone's, I think, is pleased with it, which just feels good. It feels good.
Absolutely. And is that unusual that a project takes as long as this for you?
Yeah, exactly. We kind of, Anne and I were really kind of trained and a bit traumatized in that whole first thought, best thought. Did you, I don't know if we talked about it, if you heard the Lords of Howling, our previous kind of incarnation?
If it's online, I have.
Anyway. I don't know how much is even online, but we worked with a person who was, you know, into writing thousands of songs to combat evil, and you know, and and it was just like, first you recorded, you know, and you just like, we were playing songs, you know, on stage that we had never heard before, and this person was just generating, you know, in this kind of mythic way, and so we came out of that and just weren't really comfortable to being with something that at long, you know, a long period of time, or doing it again and again.
Yeah.
He's like, I sang it that way. That's got to be the way it's got to be. You didn't know how to do something twice. Didn't know how to fix it because we didn't, you know, hadn't really been trained that way.
So this is a new methodology as well as being a longer project.
And that's absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And that was itself dictated by the form of Escort Mission, as in this song evolved in that particular way, and then it set you on this course.
Which that's the mission, I guess, right?
Yeah, I guess so. And is it not about battling evil anymore?
You know, I was never comfortable with that concept.
Yeah.
Battling evil.
No, well, it's in the gospel, don't it? Resist not evil.
Resist not means, does that mean not battle it? Or?
Yeah, I mean, well, I think, I mean, one can split hairs, and words, of course, are important, but I think it's in the same ballpark, isn't it?
Right.
It's the principle of martial arts, that what you resist grows stronger.
Was that again?
It's a principle in martial arts as well as Christianity, right, that what you resist grows stronger.
Exactly. And I think that's what we witnessed. That kind of, yeah, that kind of blew up that. I would love to send you some. You might enjoy, you know, it had a lot of mythic language. It had a lot of biblical references.
Right.
You know, it was a lot of trying to be. I think Anne even brought it up once. It was like, and it started out trying to do better, but then it became to be better, to like be better than others. You're not a self-improvement, to try to, you know, exist better, you know, to fight evil then becomes, you know, the opposite. I think it was, it became, it felt destructive, and it kind of exploded.
Oh, well, that does sound like a whole rabbit hole we could go down.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if we should or not. I think we can put it on the back burner and know that we can go back there if we run out of.
I actually think what we should do is
yeah.
We can. It would be nice to talk to the subject at hand, and then I would I'll send you a little greatest hits of it, because I think, again, I know that you would appreciate some of the way language is used, and there were certainly good moments, bright lights, and good moments, and it, the way language is used, and the subject, and the ambitiousness too, I think you'd appreciate.
And it sounds as though, I mean, just at first pass from what you said, because I feel this way as a writer, that I had to learn about the ways not to do it, or the ways that didn't really work for me as a being, in order to really find the way that did work for me.
Yes, exactly. And I feel the same way, kind of coming out of the shadow of a much larger personality that inspired and also taught me a lot. You know, I have to admit that I learned songwriting and a lot of the things about the arts. And then just to jump ship at some point, you know, I just had to parachute out of that thing.
Right. That's definitely a parallel. So another parallel then, to bring it back to Escort Mission, I was in the thrift store today and a lady came in and she asked me what books I was working on. And I said, I always find that difficult to answer. So I really have to think about that. And I thought about it and I came back with an answer. And then I explained to her that it's hard for me to say what books I'm working on, because I often don't really know whether what I'm working on is a book or not. And what I've found out is that things I work on that I think are a book, or if I set about to write a book, often I hit a wall and I find out, well, this wasn't a book at all. It was just my own, you know, whatever we would call that, my own will trying to forge something out of materials that I thought I understood but I didn't. And on the other hand, the books that I've written, particularly lately, I didn't realize they were books when I started them.
I've read other writers say the exact same thing. They thought they were going to write a little essay and it became a book.
Right. So then it's like the material itself is dictating the form, and so that seems with what you said with Escort Mission. So,
I never saw in that broad, because I usually work song by song.
Right.
But I never saw in terms of a project. And this project was, definitely determined in that way. And again, Escort Mission did drag it into that. And we ended up redoing things many times in that in mind, sonically, even from a technical point of view, but probably also from a kind of a artistic point of view as well. And also like kind of the weight, matching the weights of them.
So the weights of what exactly?
Of the song, you know, the song, of the experience, or the weight of its, does that make, the weight of the finished product, you know.
The whole album was equally distributed?
Yeah, it was weight, yes, exactly.
Right. So, but that's when you've already got several songs. So I'm curious about, and I'll explain my process and you can tell me how similar it is or not. The way that an essay turns into a book for me is that I write the essay and I find that it's not working because it's the weight distribution. There's too much weight. It can't withstand the structure that I've created, can't withstand the weight of it or what's trying to rest on it. So then I have to create more structure and then redistribute the weight.
Exactly.
Was it similar then? The Escort Mission, the song itself, somehow seemed to have so much content that the one song form couldn't contain it.
Probably, but less consciously, because we just, you know, we always want to make it. Bands always want to make an album.
And writers want to write a book, yeah.
Yeah. But you're right. But I think sometimes, you know, an album might just be 60 minutes of songs that don't interact together, but in this case,
yeah,
you know, it's 40 minutes, but 40 minutes of songs that really all kind of move, you know, that kind of resonate together very strongly. So yes, I think it resonated out, and it kind of didn't allow any songs in that it didn't approve of.
So you were So you were writing songs and then finding that they just weren't compatible?
Yeah, though the song, all but one song was written, but we had, like I said, 25 songs. And this other song, they just felt like, no, they just don't fit with this. They don't fit with this. And we just kept chucking them. We kept jettisoning them to keep the, you know, the weight concept and like the, you know, the craft, the ship. We were throwing songs overboard.
Right.
Desperate. Just a, you know, desperate, insane flight, you know. And then we ended up with the songs that you know, that that traveled, that went together well, or, you know, I felt that same weight. I think that's the one that resonates with me now. It's the weight. They kind of waited out together, and then we kind of balanced it too, to put it all, you know, to sequence it. We had a few sequences, and then we shuffled those down. And then there's the last bit, is the technology of a vinyl album can really only have 20 minutes per side. And so you have to balance those numbers.
Right. Oh, okay. So it actually dictates
that.
Yeah.
So the physical, and that we were all determined to make an album, even as impractical as they are, you know, physically and financially. But we were all determined. And so it finally gave the final call that they were 20 minutes aside, and they would have to fit, and they would have to, you know, go together well.
So that's like you're adhering to a tradition.
Yes, exactly.
That provides structure.
Yeah, I think so. And say, as if you had to write a book in the days when, you know, a book was 120 pages or something.
Or even more, because actually Prisoner Infinity, the last two books I had to keep to a certain length because otherwise the price would go right up.
Exactly.
And I found that it was very hard, like it kept wanting to go over, but I was always near the border, so I was negotiating for an extra 5,000 words, and I managed to get that, but then I absolutely had to stick to it. And so it did, it kept me in check, I could say.
Yeah, a technical aspect, a cold, hard, you know, scientific aspect, which I think is awesome. I think that's, you know, you go all the way back, and, you know, I think of things like little, you know, Bach or whatever, fitting things into a dance, you know, whatever. They had rules, they had to fit, you know. I kind of always like that and respect that, you know, it had to fit into that form. And so we had 20 minutes aside, you know, we fit it in, and a song or two got ditched, and one got written just to fit. The end of side B was written to be the end of side B, so.
Oh.
That's why it's called that, so.
So you mean you created a song specially to complete?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I wrote it while we were almost done, and we all recorded it, and then we put it on there.
Oh, that must have been very satisfying.
Yeah, it was fun.
That's like, I think that's, go ahead.
I think someone giggled that it was a bit of hubris or whatever to think I would just like know that was going to be the last song. And but when I was writing it, I every once in a while you're in that space that's kind of expansive, and you're well aware that the song you're writing is going to be the last song on that side B, and I just named it that because I was in that zone, and I just felt, you know, I was happy.
Well, it reminds me of when as a writer, when I finish the book and I write the afterword, there's nothing easier than writing the afterword because the structure's all there and you're just filling in the last bit. And basically the totality of it dictates the nature of that last little bit.
Exactly. Unless it became a whole nother book.
Yeah.
Which has probably happened, you know, for some people.
Lack of discipline.
Yeah. So we have that. Yeah, and we've been really happy with it. I'm happy with it. I like sharing it. I like listening to it. So it's like, it's subtle. You know, it's not really high pitched. You know, it's just kind of hums along.
Why? Some of it? You mean some of your other work is more high pitched?
No, I don't think so. No. Yeah, some of the stuff that doesn't ever make it out of the studio can be. Yeah.
So let's talk about those 25 songs then. What during what period were they written?
The songs were all written over this last, since the last, like since 2014, the last 4 years.
Okay.
And I basically was writing them, and the studio was basically in my house, and so I would, you know, start them by myself and make a mess of it, and, you know, everyone would come visit the group kind of comes and visit, usually separately. So I had a lot of one-on-ones where they would sit there with just a guitar and be expected to play drums. You know, Max would be expected to play drums with a guitar track, and I'd be like, "Oh, you know this one. You got it." You know, everyone was a great sport about that, and then we would do it, and then they would just, you know, veer off to the left, kind of like some veer off to the right, and yeah.
And at this point, this was before there was a sense that you were gathering material for an album.
Right, except at first I had this idea of making a cassette tape. So I was, the thing that freed me up with that was, and it didn't have that same structure, or like, an album's really expensive to make. So you really kind of, you know, you really kind of have to feel really strongly about everything. Whereas a cassette is that kind of opposite, where you really want to just put the stuff that, you know, no one will listen to this, or no one can like this, you know, which, and those are magical pieces too.
Yeah.
But when you make those and you're just like, this is just really going on. So the cassette, and that kind of got shot down, like, no, we're not going to do a cassette. And then I thought, oh, a double album, that'll solve that problem. So that would have given me 80 minutes.
Yeah.
That was extremely expensive. And also, I don't even like double. I never liked anyone's double albums. I always liked the one, you know.
You didn't like the White Album?
I do, but I would really just like it, you know. It's
condensed, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I love all of it, and it's the only Beatles album I could actually listen to.
Right.
It's not like one where you really get, you know, deeper and deeper and deeper into one. I don't know.
There's two things I wanted to go to now. Let's stay with the songs. Okay, so you've got a whole bunch of songs, and at a certain point, the discussion with the group, the others, you decide it's just going to be a single album. So then at that point, the energy changes. And are you still writing songs at that point? Or is
I have, yeah. Once I kind of got fully into it, I get up in the morning and kind of chiseling away at songs. Though lately I haven't, I've been taking a break to really kind of, I'm in kind of internet mode and mail out mode and research mode, you know, I'm trying to find places to send the record to. I'm not writing it at all, but when we got in the thick of the album, I wasn't really writing any more songs. So there wasn't any more new. I wrote that one, you know, coming out of a fever one day. And, you know, kind of, you know, it was just there, the end of side B. But no, I wasn't writing anymore. So it was only a matter of attrition at that point. There wasn't going to be any new. Also, I knew that I kind of made a promise that I wasn't going to introduce any more new stuff to this batch. I think it would have driven people crazy to just have to think about more new stuff.
Right. Right.
Because they weren't going to get the attention that it would have taken to, you know, to be at that level, to be at that, you know, to be worked on that much. So then I thought, you know, anything new is just going to be a new thing. A door kind of just closed.
Jesus said the poor in heart will always be with us. Said, forget the words, and everything's delicious. I say the reason never answers what I really wish it would. I say. Thank you. said, yeah, go ahead. And hate love if you can. You're all on pins and needles down here. Ever since this place began, you say you're never answer what you really wish they would. You say your wishes are no good.
And so then the process of selecting the songs that would make the grade and end up on the album began, and that was a process of just of redoing the songs and performing the songs and just seeing how they evolved.
Yeah, they would evolve. You know, we were just playing them on it. You know, we were just recording them. They weren't. It wasn't so much the value of the songs, because I kind of liked all the songs. It was just, you know, the classic moment would be you would bring up a song, you know, on the tape, and the person, you know, the whoever else was in the band would just be kind of like, and you would sense that it wasn't really moving them, you know. So you'd play another one, and they'd be like, I don't know, you know. And then on the third one, they'd be like, yes, let's work on this.
Right,
you know? Right. So I almost was like, I was in the position of not so much ringmaster, but it was almost like, you know, I'm losing my audience here.
Yeah.
Even within the band, it was like, I got to find something that people, you know, that someone's inspired to work on. So we would kind of, if someone came over, we would play a few songs and be like, oh yeah, let me play, I hear something, let me play on this one. And it would, and then they would take it a step up, you know, they would move along up the, you know, up the ladder, or just get a little more focused and get a little more. And then a few were just really gems. There was no, that right away was just gonna make it. The other than Escort Mission, the song for me that made me really want to finish the album was Jesus Said, which is that eight-minute piece, which I actually is my favorite on the whole thing.
I think it's a little early for me to say, but I think that was mine also so far. It was the one song I was gonna ask you about.
Of course, I figured that's why we're here. And for me, that was a really special moment. It was, I think it was special for all of us when we played on it. It was all just in my living room, and Anne's piano part was really beautiful, and Max's drumming is really stunning, and Kevin's guitar, everything's really kind of just like spot on and just stunning. And I mean, the only issue became there was a thought that it wasn't going to need to be that long. And I was like, no, it absolutely has to be this long. It has to be 8 minutes. You know, it just has to keep going and going.
Yeah.
I wanted a song with 4 minutes of outro, and I wanted that 1 minute of, you know, like ambient space before it. And there was nothing practical about that. It was just the way that song just shaped itself, you know. The writing of that song, it was very simple. It was just a little folk song to me, you know, on a guitar. So I wanted to place it in some kind of other context, but, you know, the original crafting of words and, you know, chords is a really simple little thing. It's a little folk piece, a little fairy tale.
Sure. So, you know, you're describing earlier how the songs interact together, and the sort of common profane idea of albums of that kind is a concept album, but that, to my mind, that's something that exaggerates in order to get noticed, really.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't, like, my favorite albums that have what you're talking about, something like Fear of Music, where all the songs do seem to, there seems to be a story that's unfolding, and perhaps story isn't quite the word, but it's a perspective that is developing and unfolding as the songs proceed. So that, as you say, they're all interacting together and they're commenting off each other, and whatever it is that's getting worked out by the sensibility is unfolding, you know, and then that translates to the listener. So that's subtler than a concept album, but...
But I think going to our very first discussion is that wanting to define things, concept album, you know, I think of like worst case scenarios like Tommy or something.
Yeah.
You know, but not wanting to define something is where you sense cohesiveness, but you never, the listener nor the maker never needs to define what it actually is. And it could be either beyond words or just not necessary, but the cohesiveness is there, that it's a group.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it could say, oh, it's the idea of concept album is certainly in commercial sense is usually a little more focused and then potentially a musical, you know, heading towards that direction.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas really what we're talking about here is just, as you say, an album that has coherence, that has integrity. Not in the moral sense, but in the sense that all the parts fit together and they work together. And thinking also of, if probably maybe not somebody you're particularly fond of, I don't know, but Bruce Springsteen, early days, Darkness at the Edge of Town, he also recorded dozens of songs during that period. And of course now they're all available because he's Bruce Springsteen. And you can hear that a lot of the songs that didn't make on the album were really good songs, maybe even better than some of the songs that did make it. But you can also see why he threw those ones overboard and just kept this tight crew on the ship, because it was like a excavation or something. Like he was trying to uncover the shape of something in his own psyche, and those were the parts that really fit together.
Yeah, and at that time to us, he needed it to be focused. You know, now at this part in his career, and also Spotify gives me a perfect example, because, you know, I listen to a lot of music at work, and now everyone's putting out the album with 25 songs with the separate remix, the one without cuss words, the third mix that someone else did, you know, the live version, and you're like, okay, you know, everything's that way. And it's digital has that kind of, it isn't, and it costs you anymore to put up a song with 25 or 12, but songs on it. But the album certainly does, you know. And it's just like you have to, you know. I like the idea of jettisoning something, and maybe you won't ever hear it again, or maybe, you know, it's lost. But you know, sooner or later it comes back, and it all, you know.
Well, isn't it also that it remains in some ghostly form, like you've sacrificed him, but the spirit still lives on because it died for the cause?
Yeah, I think so. I think, or it's in echoes, or it's what gives something its shadow. It gives it its shadow, and it gives it its echo. You know, I love echo, as you know. There's a lot of echo and delay and kind of reverberation. And there's that actual aspect of it, and there's that kind of spiritual aspect, that those songs that aren't, you know, that didn't make it.
Well, it's something, I mean, there's even the cliche, and who it was, one of the poets, T.S. Eliot, or somebody said, kill all your darlings. It's a cliche for writers particularly, I think, that you have the things that you're particularly attached to in the work are often the things that have to go. It's quite Buddhist too. And I certainly found that myself, that because it's, if one stays focused on the parts at the cost of the whole, then the whole will suffer, and then the parts won't, you know, they won't shine, because they'll stand out, and they're actually there's disharmony with the whole, so they don't even look that great anyway. So I found that, and it's particularly, it's a discipline that's particularly obvious with essay writing, is that you have to make your points and you have to be clear. You might have a brilliant line and a brilliant insight, but if it doesn't hold the whole piece together and help the reader to follow the chain of reasoning and understand what you're trying to say, then it's actually going to sabotage, you know, the whole thing. You'll have a mutiny on the ship, to keep with that analogy. So yeah, it has to go, right?
No, I agree. I agree to the end result, but I never liked that. I always kind of bristled at that phrase for a couple reasons.
Which phrase?
Kill your darlings.
Yeah.
I bristled because I thought, and it was a long time ago when the phrase might have been more effective. I always thought, well, if you were a writer in control of your, you know, your art, you would either be aware that those had to go, and then you wouldn't have called them darlings in the first place,
right?
You know, or you would have already done it. But also the other possibility is, you know, just leave them all in. What's the, you know, you know, who are we writing for? You know, if you love it, leave it in. And that's what I say. That was the original cassette tape, was just like, just leave all those darlings in there, man. Just like,
right, but you didn't go.
It's
that
like a
route.
Family of seven coming over to your house for dinner. It's kind of like, well, we do love you, but we can't do this very often.
Too often, right? Right. Well, I see what you're saying, but I suppose I would counter that it relates to if my ego is getting in the way, my personal preference, you know, my personal whims. It is going to get in the way. Like, as far as I still have an ego, I know that it interferes with a deeper process that's happening, which is letting something that's unconscious come to the surface and emerge and be articulated and be seen by me, and it's going to be threatening to me. I mean, I've been working on a book recently, well, for years actually, on and off, and just can't quite get it right, and it's fiction and non-fiction, and it's both and it's neither, and the subject matter is certain aspects of it are threatening to me. I don't agree with that. I'm like, I don't want to be the voice for this, and that, I think that is, isn't that part of the creative process, that it does allow for us to discover things and actually expose things in ourselves that we might not want to see?
Yes, I think, of course, I think that's part of it. And I mean, again, writing can be just writing. I mean, again, it can be just leaving everything in and let the reader sort it out, which I don't know. I mean, there's those books. They're not always that pleasant.
Right.
But the opposite, I was working in a collaborative space. And like I said earlier, where I was having to really sell the songs to get people to come work on them. Mm. There was a bit of that weeding out already. And in terms of ego, I was kind of like, okay, I'm not going to get my, you know, feelings hurt. I can stick this on the, you know, that mystery cassette, you know, in the future. So I always could kind of, I could let the songs go. They were still on tape, though. We would record right over some things, you know, like that is, you know, we never want to hear that again. So the collaborative process can do that already. Yeah. You know, a writer is not necessarily in a group.
No, generally.
I guess writers have editors sometimes, but
if they're lucky, they have a good editor. Yeah, and sometimes they have a circle of other writers if they're really lucky. But
But also, I mean, but in terms of ego, there was a lot of, for me, it was letting people have their say and knowing what to let go of to move forward. And so I guess, yeah, there's truth. I just never liked the phrase, kill your darling. So.
I'm not fond of it, actually. Yeah. I just thought it was...
No, of course, I'm not.
It was appropriate in terms of, this is a...
I don't know if anyone likes that phrase.
An aspect, no. No, well, anyway, it's become a cliche. It's been overused, so it probably should be killed. It's too many people's darling.
I think it's probably the person I first heard it from. I didn't like their writing, and I thought, you know, if this is your way to the truth, it certainly isn't going to work for anyone at this point.
Right.
I think that was most of it, but
well, that
I that's... think I agree that there's a I like edited work. You know, it's I like the really expansive. You know, I'm a big fan of the books I like to read over and over is Swan's Way. You know, Search of Lost Time.
Is that Remembrance of Things Past?
Yeah. They've changed it. The titles. But, you know, it's been actually, there's a great new translation, and they're using the actual literal. The literal translation is In Search of Lost Time. So.
Hmm.
But that's I don't know if I'm qualified, or that's a digression. That book is one long, like, that book is like, you know, just exploring the digression and following that thought. So.
Mm.
And it certainly doesn't make me think of killing darlings. And so. It's more like embracing darlings. Write a book about your darlings. So.
Mm. Well, you did begin with the metaphor of throwing people off the ship. So
yeah,
I think you opened the doorway for that.
Yeah. And I think this was really as critical as we could get, and as edited as we could get. And I think it is right. I think there's truth to the editing, because I think what I'm liking about this album is not really personal statements. It was things that are really finely edited and less, you know, that's completely submerged into the music.
Hmm.
That makes sense.
So, one of the things I've been thinking about lately as I get older perhaps is like writing is something I've spent half my life doing, or more than actually almost all my life doing, and so as with you, a musician, you end up creating albums and it feels good, you want the structure, you want the product, you want the finalization of a given process, and so I do that with books, I do it with an essay, and I have it over and over again throughout my life. I have this creative process that ends with this finished thing, and then I just, you know, push it aside and move on to the next thing. So of course the recurring question is, what's it all for? Like, what's actually happening here? You know, what's being done? So, and I have some thoughts about that, but rather than just, you know, just keep talking, I'm curious what your feeling is now that you're at this point. You've completed the album, and now you're moving into the next phase, which is distributing or introducing it to the world. And that's also part of the process, but a very different part. What's your feeling about actually what the point of it all is?
I think, well, it's a learning experience. It's like a, you know, like a trip around the sun in a certain way. It's like a full circle, or like a dance. It has a beginning and an end. I think it's like a lifetime. I think it could feel like a lifetime happened. It definitely feels like a lifetime happened.
Mm.
You know, as I'm out, I feel outside of it. And I think it was, now it's like, oh, you know, like a little, what do they call the thing? You know, the thing they read at the funeral or whatever.
A life well lived.
You know, it was like, you know, looking back fondly, there were no shortcuts, you know, there was nothing regrets. And it was, so it feels like a life well lived, like, and so that experience is beautiful and stuff and complete, like a flower, like a, you know, the season of a garden,
right,
from start to beginning. You know, the writing's very, you know, the writing itself starts out really expansive. You know, you don't, the verses haven't really solidified, you don't really know the beginning or the end, you don't really know what it's about, and then you kind of have a feeling of what it's about, and then it's finished enough to share to some people, and then it, as it gets onto like the recorded process, it gets kind of like, oh, there it is. It has a length. The length gets kind of determined, and then it kind of filters in and things. You know, like you said, we leave things out that we really that we liked a lot, and then it was done, and then you with an album, you go and master it. You know, it gets cut into a lacquer, and it's really done. You probably will never work on those songs again. You know?
Right.
And so, yeah, it feels kind of beautiful. It kind of, I guess it feels, it's just an experience of beauty that starts beginning, middle, and end, you know, all those parts. And I don't really feel, I enjoyed it so much. I don't really feel I need anything to show for it. You know, we want it to pay for itself. We want it to recoup, you know, in those words. But I think it certainly wasn't our goal in making it, and will certainly survive if it doesn't. So.
But you wanted the physical album.
Yeah.
So that is literally something to show. Right? Even if
I think it was something to show, and also something that had, again, the weight of a project.
Hmm. The weight of a project, yeah.
But it makes me think sometimes of Shakespeare, where, you know, there's always that line where he's always like, you know, the set's going to come down. Like, for actors, you know, and especially in those days when it wasn't being filmed and it wasn't recorded, it was just kind of like, wow, this is, if you've ever acted in a play,
yeah,
which is fun, I've done it, and it's like, you know, you come to the end of the play, it's like, wow, this is all done. We did this thing.
Yeah, it's
ephemeral. And that really passes into people maybe in a spiritual way, like what, because it doesn't have a physical thing, you know, nothing's left behind. It's like done, you pack up and off you go.
Right, just maybe the program if it was printed and some photos if people took photos, but yeah.
Yeah, but certainly in those days there's that poignancy in a Shakespeare play where he really kind of is like, we've come to the end and we're all going to leave. And,
yeah.
Well, and I think there were epilogues, speaking of there were epilogues that I don't think survived, that, where they would have a little more of that kind of poignancy about the play.
Right. I was going to say, I mean, that ephemerality that you're saying is particularly apparent with a play. It extends to everything anyway, regardless of, you know, even
right,
Michelangelo's
exactly.
David is going to be.
Or gone. Even the vinyl. Yeah, exactly. I mean, exactly, in a sense that it really embraces ephemerality in a way that, you know, so many things try not to, you know, like, it's on a CD or it's on an album lasts longer than the CD. You know, what lasts longer, which is more sturdy, you know. And
well, yeah, maybe that's part of the illusion or the delusion, or the crucial fiction of the digitalized age and the digitalized medium, is that on the one hand, as you said, there's no necessity to respect boundaries or acknowledge boundaries or limits. You can just put all 80 songs on your, you know, work because it's not a physical thing anyway.
Right.
And on the other hand, there's no reason to acknowledge its ephemerality because you're embracing ephemerality, but with the illusion that it's actually eternal because it's, the digital cloud is somehow going to, you know, outlast the death of the sun and you know, live on in the fifth dimension.
Right. And so, right. And I mean, so many things, so many subjects, right, where we have to try to escape ephemerality, maybe.
Mm. Mortality, yeah.
Mortality, exactly.
Mm.
I was getting my tires changed, and there was a, you know, the TV was going in the little tire place, and it was all about aliens coming. I don't want to get, but I know it's certainly a subject you guys, that you talk about. And it was just this kind of thing, like, yeah, and they're going to come and, you know, they're going to come and save us. This concept, they come and, what it would mean to come and save or come and, you know, would they come and end ephemerality?
Yeah.
Would they get rid of pollution or to get, you know, like get rid of the president? And that's, you know, these, what saving us would possibly mean, but would they even get rid of life, you know, mortality? You know, that would be the, that would be a different kind of switch.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the dream. That's the transhumanist dream. That's the religious dream. That's the extraterrestrial dream. I used to believe that extraterrestrials were creating a fifth dimensional body for me, and they were going to move my consciousness into it in the end times because I was one of the chosen few. I literally believed that. I don't know how 100%, but I, you know, I had that lottery ticket in my back pocket.
Right. I mean, I guess everyone, you know, has something that, you know, or they think, you know, well, the album will be in somebody, you know, someone's stack, or it'll still be generating royalties, you know, or whatever, which is, everyone has a sense of, I know, you know, I don't understand fifth dimension, you know, dimensions beyond three or whatever, but I just meant, everyone has a way out, you know, or a way, you know.
A crucial fiction. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Magical thinking, I guess that's how I heard it.
Yeah.
Or maybe a different thing. But maybe, yeah, how, maybe the point is experiencing that ephemerality, you know.
Well, it's a
bit, beautiful way.
It's, yeah, it's paradoxical, isn't it? Because it's the carnality, it's our incarnated self, you know, existence that is far from ephemeral. I mean, it's solid, it's present, it's flesh and bone, right? There's nothing ephemeral about life, except that it is all, you know, reduced to dust, you know, in the context of eternity. So it's ephemeral in that sense that it's just so fleeting.
You mean being alive?
Yeah, I just mean being alive, like, okay, well, the way that we're communicating now, it's kind of ephemeral because we're using this media and we're not even in the same room, but our respective experience of being here, potentially at least, and I think this is getting to what I was getting to me, there's the point of all this, these pursuits, potentially the experience of being here is the opposite of ephemeral. I mean, not in the sense it's eternal, maybe that too, but that it's just so raw and physical and visceral, you know?
experience. And I think maybe we're not aware enough about, you know, like they say, the last breath here is the first breath, you know, somewhere, Rumi says, somewhere else. So we don't, maybe we're not in touch with that kind of echoing of our own, you know, existence, coming and going, coming and going, coming and going, you know, seeing ourselves from such a larger space. I mean, the arts sometimes feel beyond that ephemerality. Maybe that's another reason they do seem indestructible, or the, you know, the music of the heavens or whatever, things that just echo and echo and echo. They do seem larger than us, larger than the individual.
Well, that seems to be what, I mean, that's what I was getting when you were talking about the point of it for you, was to experience, well, what you were describing seemed to me like the cyclical nature of existence. So you said living and dying, I can't remember your exact words, but the whole process of the creative process, you're bringing something into form and then you're in a certain sense burying it. Okay, well, let's say the album is the tombstone. and so that's a cyclical thing that transcends our finite existence, because that's nature itself, is just constantly regenerating. It's going on for billions of years, possibly even eternally, if we think of universes dying and being reborn and so on. So we're just, you know, down on this very microscopic scale, but it's still it's a replica or a reflection of something that does extend far beyond the, you know, the merely human realm.
Right. So you get to be part of something that is bigger than yourself, as people often say.
Yeah. Well, of course we are. So I think there's an irony, or is it irony the word? Maybe it's a tragedy, that so much of the artistic pursuit is about trying to big yourself up and become bigger than yourself. And that takes it in the opposite direction to what we're talking about, I think. And of course, humility can be false, and one can be, but like, for example, a few years ago, I built a set of stairs, a staircase for this attic where I'm sitting now. And I'm not a carpenter, I've never built stairs before, I've never built anything before, hardly. Said about, yeah, I'm going to build a set of stairs. I know it's not going to be easy, but I can work it out. And I did it. I figured it out. I had to use my mind. I had to use my hands. Had to, and so on and so forth. So I built these stairs, and I built them well, and they're very solid, and they're still working fine. You know, they've held up through the years, right? And what a surprise it was to me that I felt more proud of that flight of stairs that I'd built than any of my creative projects. Even though I knew I wasn't going to get any credit for it, and really nobody was going to be impressed, you know, just me, my wife, she was a little bit impressed. It really grounded me, and the whole project of working on this house is like, well, creativity isn't what I thought it was, and there's an aspect to creativity that also, because I don't mean to this make this the cliche that, you know, building a table or set of stairs is more useful than an album, therefore it's more satisfying. I think what I was discovering there, and it's taken time, you know, in the subsequent years, is that one can approach writing and art and music in the same spirit as one builds a set of stairs, as in it's a way to really discover new ways in which to interact with our environment physically. Yeah.
Sure. I think that's a great way to look at it. I mean, I spent 20 years, you know, installing wood floors, you know, to pay the bills. And one thing I thought was, well, if I can learn how to do this, I can learn how to write a song. You know, I didn't even want to learn how to put in microphones. And I wanted to learn how to write a song. There was that. Yeah. But also, you know, the same the structure, when you make a staircase, you're not like, oh, I think I'll just do whatever I want. You know, you're like, you know, you looked up some rule, you know, there's some, you know, making stringers, there's like a little, there's not much, you know, wiggle room there.
You
do it the way it's supposed to. And maybe that was satisfying too. You were just to be that vehicle, to just be the.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that's right. To learn about the principles of reality and I won't say obey them. I don't particularly like that word, but respect them and interact with them and learn from them. Let them teach me. And it's the same with the whole house, because you're renovating a house, you can't fuck around. You've got to, it's really hard work and you're just trying to make it a good house to live in. You don't care hardly even how it looks. We certainly don't care, you know, if you get to express yourself through it, right?
I think that's the same. I think making the record many times was like that. You know, you're in there, you're doing a guitar part. You're like, okay, you know, please be done expressing yourself. That's not working. You know, do the part that works.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what it is. And in a sense that your ego is thinking, oh, that guitar part was already there. But as the thing takes shape, it's like, yeah, just play it. Mm. You know, just play that one. You know, we don't need, you know, it's not about expressing yourself. It's about playing the part that's going to work, that make so you can climb the thing. So the thing doesn't fucking fall over, or, you know, it doesn't, you know, collapse. And there's those moments where you really do. I mean, creativity for me has now become more problem solving than expressing myself, because I'm not that self-aware to know what that means. You know, I tend to just, when it's my moment to express myself, I tend to just bang on things. You know, I don't have like some kind of larger poetic, you know, phraseology to deal with. But to go back to stair making, there might be that one moment where you really had to solve one little problem, because the two floors weren't a proper distance apart, and you had to, you know, figure out how you're going to solve that one problem.
Yeah.
Or something was an inch off, or something wasn't level, and there you go, there's your little moment. But the rest is just, you know, getting it to code.
Yeah.
The code, the great code, you know. And I think with a book too, you know, you're often, you like you said with your essay, you have to get you're trying to make a convincing argument. You know, that's nuts and bolts, you know, to say A and B and then C, you know. And there might have been one little moment where a turn of a phrase was fine, but the rest was just getting it done. And there's nothing, I don't know. Making a project. That was the joy of it, just getting it done. Not in any dark way or any kind of, you know, bitter way, but just showing up at the piano and put the piano right where it belongs and, you know, and don't dance around it too much.
has gone to see what voice is left in me. Love has gone to see what voice is left in me. The nightbirds call us out. We follow through the dawn on a woven breath of light. And the cries that linger on, implicit is surrender as the sun.
Thank you.
Well, isn't it that the process itself, I mean, that implies an end point, because the process, something's being processed, so it has to end, it has to be done, but the process itself is showing us something. This is like a teacher, even. The process is a teacher of some kind.
I think when you have structure, and it comes from other things and other disciplines. You talked about martial arts or whatever, which can be, I do yoga every morning in the same way, like, you know, it's not a creative thing. I do the same thing every morning. You sometimes have more vision, more self-awareness by doing the same thing, mm-hmm. than getting up and saying, what will I do? And I do whatever I want this morning. You know, somehow that discipline and repetitiveness creates a field where you somehow see yourself, or you know, have more vision that way.
So are you applying that then to performing songs and perfecting songs, because you're doing the same thing over and over?
Yeah, I think sometimes instead of, you know, that kind of where the improvisation is kept to a minimum or almost none, you go into a different moment and you play the same thing, and you have this, you see how you somehow see the contours of the universe, or I'm not phrasing it right, but you see the contours of
something. Something.
I'm now have waded out of my depth a little bit talking about.
That's good. I mean, that's the point of these conversations, I think. I was speaking to my niece recently, and she's 22, and she's a musician, and she's at music school, in fact, in Leeds, and she was saying she only really likes performing if it's with other people, but besides that, she doesn't really like performing. She just likes writing the songs and then moving on and writing new ones, and what she really doesn't, she hasn't found a way to enjoy about being a musician is the repetition, about doing the same song over and over again. And I say, well, I'm the same, but I'm not a musician. But it was one of the things that I just ended up, I just didn't persist with my guitar and singing, because I just never really, in the way that I can write a piece and then rewrite it countless times, and the joy and the excitement never goes away until it's done, I didn't have that experience with music, songwriting.
Well, I like it when it's ephemeral and I'm kind of reeling it in, but it does eventually, you know, by the end when you're done, you have this song and it does have a shape. I mean, it's a good reason to kind of keep, I don't know if it's loose ends, but is, especially for me, the language has to be open.
The lyrics, you mean?
Yeah, the lyrics. So for me, I call it the language. In the terms of the language that I'm going to be singing, it has to be much something that much more opens. It's almost like what do you like witches say, or whatever, like a
I don't know, what do they say?
A spell. It's a spell. Right. Yeah. So the language is casting a spell on myself to open my mind to just see what it's going to see. So the language isn't so concise that I don't want to say it again and again. I almost want to say it again and again, the language. Then the language casts the spell for me. I don't know how it is for other people, but that's, and so I'm happy to sing it over and over. I mean, for your niece, that, you know, she might be at a stage where what she's writing isn't going to sustain her interest, but at some point, as it becomes broader, you're like, yeah. But also what happens is the songs that don't just drop away, you kind of forget them. But as you start to create a curriculum and a card, you know, a set, you know, a little field, the ones that you, especially if you're playing, you play by yourself, you're playing the song that you feel like playing next, you know, it just comes to you, and then you play it. I often play without a set list, and I'll just, you know, see what comes to me. I have a lot of songs, so it's not like I'm gonna not think of something, but there's always one that wants to be played, and I never, you know, it's just kind of, it casts its little spell. So I don't think, oh, I'm singing about some rotten day I had at school when some kid threw an orange at me. I mean, unless I did, and that, you know, that opened up my mind to another event. But I'm not, not, I, yeah, I could see that the specific thing would feel repetitive, but I'm not, I don't have experience of repetition. I have experience of expansiveness.
Hmm. Do you think that this will be one of the advantages of marginality, that the relationship between you and the songs that come through you remains quite intimate, as compared, I'm thinking of David Byrne or somebody who has to play Psycho Killer or feels like he has to play Psycho Killer, you know, 10 times a year for 30 years, because he's, it's created its own, you know, audience cult that,
right,
you know, summons or invokes the presence, and that's beyond, that becomes beyond the author's own power to control it.
Yeah, I've never been in the position where I had an audience that demanded that I play
uh-huh.
you know, a thing. And but, you know, and at some point like that, we say like it feels like a job. And he feels like, oh, I have to go out and do Psycho Killer. But, you know, he can also look at the fact that the rest of us, especially everyone in the audience, had to, you know, go and throw the laundry in at their job or wash the dishes or put all the napkins and the forks. You know, it's like, you know, when he goes into his little cafe, he wants to see the fork and the napkins out there, but he doesn't need to have the waiter be like, look, dude, I'm not going to just put out the forks and the napkins for you.
Uh-huh.
You expect me to every time, man.
Well, maybe that's he awful. Does tell himself that, though. But would
maybe
you...
he does. I don't know. I've never heard of, I've heard of musicians grousing about having to play songs. I've never heard that about him. I don't know anything about it.
No.
I actually don't think that's a bad song. To, I wouldn't have, personally, I don't know that I would mind having to go out my Psycho Killer. You know, but sometimes that he has the experience of having to do it, and that's a little bit different.
Well, because he doesn't. I said he may feel like he has to. Maybe he doesn't. Maybe he just genuinely wants to. But it seems as though it's likely that that could happen, that an artist could end up corralled into a corner by his own success, and thereby sort of becoming a slave to his own creations, because they accrue a life of their own through the audience that has invested in them and animates them in a certain sense, like with their own desire.
Right. There's also the issue with some artists and some periods of time. We talked about ephemerality in an album.
Mm.
You also have a band that has a life force, like say like the Talking Heads, and then it's over and then it's all nostalgia. And so you either take the ephemerality and you don't go back there and you don't do it again. You say it can't be done.
Mm.
Or you feel that obligation, like put the band back together and do it. I mean, they've chosen. I don't think Talking Heads have got back together.
No, no, because he wouldn't. They tried to make him.
Yeah, I would imagine it's a daily pressure. You know, there's probably someone. You know, there's someone with a financial interest in calling him up, like, "Hey, man, I know you don't want to hear this, but." You know, but again, that's never been an issue. So I haven't. The whip has never kind of come down on me to do anything, you know, to play or whatever. So.
And do you, is that
I know
something?
The experience of being the financial whip, you know, from my other jobs. So I do know that experience. And you, whatever your job is, you have to try to like suck it up and just yeah, do the best you can.
I suppose, I mean, I think there's jobs and there are jobs. Oh, this is working down a coal mine, and then there's, as you say, playing Psycho Killer every day and for a living, so to speak. But it,
that's
is...
the spectrum. Put yourself, find yourself in there, man.
Well, see, I'm probably a pretty good case study.
I love my job right now, so I feel closer to Psycho Killer than a coal mine. For sure.
But you're talking about your non-musical job.
Yes. But right. I feel that obligation. And now my non-musical job actually it intersects because it's what allows me to do my musical job. So they, I see them as, I don't see them as polar opposites or antagonistic.
Well, so I'm in the same position now because we're working in a thrift store, which I run, so I'm my own boss. I don't work very many hours, very, very few hours, actually, because it's doing quite well. But enough that You know, I feel a sense of duty and obligation to go in, and it's a little bit of a burden, but just enough, such as the house renovations were, that it feels like a healthy burden, like I'm strengthening my psychic muscles, so to speak, in terms of you know, interacting with reality and human beings in new
right.
ways. And in that sense, it's complementary more than just the fact that it's paying money that makes it possible for me to do my other creative stuff, which also generates a little bit of income, but in the sense that it's helping me to become more grounded in my life, more incarnate, more in touch with ordinary, everyday human reality, which I would have been delighted to have escaped if I could have become the next Carlos Castaneda or whoever, right, when I was young. Heaven forbid, right? But I tried.
Right,
and I ended up with much more grounded and real, but you know, apparently mundane sort of lot.
We always picture someone else, you know,
mm-hmm.
doing it. We don't know how what we know what grounds them, you know what. I mean, because in terms of Castaneda, we think of that in terms of his writing, but we don't know his. You know, I think he ended up in Malibu or something. You know, he ended up, you know, his day-to-day existence or something.
He ended up running a cult, going insane.
But he still had, like, to yell at the gardener, you know, to, like, the guy who, you know, bangs into his car. You know, everyone gets grounded soon. I think maybe that's a different subject. I always felt like everyone gets grounded soon.
Well, I think if they die of liver cancer or stomach cancer or a heroin overdose or something, eventually somebody
right, exactly.
hits the ground, but sometimes they hit so hard that they don't survive, and
right.
and that's not really getting grounded, is it? That's getting
no,
flattened.
Right, that's flat. That's, yeah. Right, you're right. So if you ground more frequently, you have a gentle rolling bounce, you know. A dance.
Back to that country rolling.
Yes, exactly. That's what we came here for. I've never been to England, but I just picture those rolling hills.
Yeah, a horse and cart. And
right.
A farmer's life. So do you ever write songs in your sleep?
I guess I'd say no. I've gotten out of my sleep and written things down, but maybe something survived, but generally not. Usually when I get out of my sleep and I remember it, I think, oh my God, I've really tapped into, like, I remember I had a dream once and I was like hearing a Neil Young song on the radio in the dream. And then I remembered a bit of it. I was like, oh my God, I mean, I've discovered the next Neil Young song, you know, and this has got to be good. You know, I kind of scrawled something down, but the songs are always a process of, that first process of elimination. They get hammered around, you know, for maybe once or twice they write them very quickly as if out of a dream, but in general, they're kind of just kind of hammered around for a long time, beaten to death, to see what's left, and really chiseled down and stuff. So, no, I wouldn't say I really had a song in a dream in that sense, like in Kubla Khan or something like that. You know.
Well, he was on opium, wasn't he?
But I mean, in that same dream, and he scrawled it all down or whatever, and
yeah.
And what of it? You know, I used to think that was like, you know, some kind of holy grail to get something out of a dream. And, you know, there's certainly, it's certainly not a poem I really think that much of or prefer, you know, prefer to the something grounded or something else. So.
Well, sure. But I think, I mean,
that's not judgment on dreams or Coleridge or whatever. It's just that.
Well, I was going to say, it doesn't strike me that that's really your focus anyway, because I know it's not mine, or I hope it's less and less, i.e. on sort of gaining access to the Akashic records and snatching the greatest treasure
exactly.
and then bringing it back here and then showing it off to everybody and, hey, look what I found, kind of thing.
That's the model. That again, a long time ago, I thought would have been the Holy Grail, and now it would have been. It would just be another trinket, you know, some kind of tchotchke, you know, because why isn't it the Kashuk, another tchotchke, another, you know, something gathering dust? Because
well, yeah.
The process is really, the process is what sustains, you know, you get up. And so, like I said, the end result was just a spell. It wasn't something to,
well, so,
off,
yeah.
It wasn't something to show off. It wasn't, so, there wasn't anything there. The whole point was, oh, there wasn't any, you know, there wasn't a song. It didn't exist. It didn't happen. I mean, I know that they're on there and we made a record.
They are, yeah, yeah.
But that's not the part we like. That's not the part that, you know, we remember. The part, I was just, a woman I was speaking to earlier was saying she has all these experiences from the songs. And I'm like, I have no idea what those are or what it would matter to me if you shared them or not. You know, it's like, because you just had the whole, it was all yours to have or whatever. Just like it was mine, you know, when I played it or listened to it.
So then that, I mean, that does suggest, and this is why I asked the question about the dream, that does suggest that the songs are, even though they're not really songs, but the things that appear temporarily to be songs as they're passing through this temporal realm, let's say, they seem to be coming from somewhere or some part of you to another part of you and affecting it.
Exactly. And I apologize, but I haven't spent any time to know what that is.
What that is.
I mean, for me, the spiritual aspect is the work, is the labor. I'm kind of a blue collar surrealist.
Right. So, okay. So then if the spiritual aspect is the work and the blue collar labor, what's the reward? I mean, what's the result? Like you say, you cast a spell on yourself through doing the work and somehow this thing happened. How does the spell change you?
There's a kind of, there was a thing, I think it was a Joseph Campbell story once, he was talking about that kind of electrical charge between the heavens and earth. And mm-hmm. I think experiencing that from top to bottom, you know, at the end of your day, you're like, yeah, I've experienced, you know, a dream space. You know, I spend a lot of times like say, oh, I'm in a kind of a dream space or a dreamy kind of space or dreaming something that could be, all the way down to that humbling moment, you know, putting the laundry detergent into the machine and, you know, hitting the button to start it, to the dreamy space. So that spell allows you to kind of experience that past, present, future, but not that, but just the extreme, like the extreme spiritual state, you know, that kind of from bliss, from a blissful state to a grounded state. So that it's not a reward, it's just a day well lived, you know, to have a song in your day, you know, it's a day well lived.
So is that
sort of chop some wood before you, right before you called, I was chopping some wood. And
are you aware, literally?
What's that?
Were you carrying water as well?
No, I wasn't. I was just trying not to cut my fingers off. It was dark out, and I was like, I definitely didn't need to be carrying water and chopping wood. That would be dangerous.
So you're talking about the sort of glow of virtue, of wiping the sweat off your brow at the end of a hard working day and just kicking your feet up and feeling.
Yeah, but I mean, for me, that day includes, I'm not all that into labor. I mean, a little bit, but I meant, that day includes a song. That day includes that spell. That's what I'm going to say. Not, I'm not like, yeah, I bucked some wood and I, you know, scrubbed the horses. And I'm not all that into all, I'm not that much into labor, just a little bit. You know, then a song, but not all dreaming either. Not all, you know, a little bit of each. And so the song is that kind of reminder from that extreme.
And do you listen back to your song? So you say you got the album and it's done. Do you revisit it?
Yeah, I listen to this one a lot. I like it, and you know, I listen to it in the car. I just listen to it for fun, and I revisit it. And it's now it's kind of outside. And if we ever, you know, when we get back to play a show, it'll be kind of like learning these songs that we, you know, kind of fell into and kind of crafted through that process. And then the new process will be learning how to play them, you know, in terms of that practical aspect of being a band and playing a song at a show. But for me, yeah, I listen to them, and it's almost as if, like, as another person did it. It's almost there. You know, it's almost there. I recognize my voice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's enjoyable. It's its own thing. Yeah, if I had to be the only audience, I'm fine with that. You know, I mean, that's the only one I know of. That's the only one I experience is myself.
What about when you play for people, like you were saying, when you're rehearsing with the band, you can feel if a song is working for the rest of the band, and so that's the song that gets thrown out and so on. So that's collaborative, clearly. Isn't it still collaborative if you're performing live with an audience? As in collaborating with the audience, I mean, not just the band.
Probably it's difficult to, you know, in this day and age, there's so many distractions. It's difficult to, I guess I can tap in a little bit to the audience, you know, and not say collaborate, because I definitely don't want to collaborate in any, like when you first start playing music, you're like, oh, we got to play faster. We're losing this audience. You know, we got to play louder. We got to play something upbeat and danceable. You know, people are like, come on, upbeat, danceable, you know, something like that. So now I wouldn't want to like tap into the sense, if I had a little mission or a set list, I would just stay with it and just let the chips fall where they may. So it wouldn't be like, oh, you know, I got to change course here. We're losing the audience. I would want to avoid that kind of mental process.
What about observing the audience and then kind of responding to their response, not at a mental level but just at a musical level?
I think you probably respond more in terms of saying, well, it's like casting a spell. If the spell is working, I think you tend to, like, you can feel that lightness. You're not like plowing through, you know. There, all of a sudden it becomes light and able, you know, you feel that kind of, you can experience a lightness and not a heaviness and not a, sometimes you feel like, wow, there's a psychic thing that just wants me to stop, you know, or whatever. And I think, and sometimes you ignore that, or you just kind of take another look or veer off, change course a little bit.
I say the answer never answers what I really wish. I say the answer is no good. Thank you.
Well, I'd say it's very interesting, like the whole thing of audience, because I don't even like the word audience, and I'm not a performer. You feel the same?
Yeah, I don't really think of myself as a performing or entertaining. I feel like, you know, if I'm asked to play, I go play, but I'm not like, okay, here we are. You know, I just never had that kind of sense.
Mm.
But I do like to play. I think live music is really a beautiful thing. Probably a more multidimensional thing than even an album can be. I kind of think.
Sure.
An album is kind of a nice document, and with the kind of magic of the studio, you do a lot of stuff that you might not be able to do live, so it actually can come alive in its own way, I think, sometimes. But live is a really beautiful experience. You just play it, you know, you see or feel how that feels. But I don't know if that answers the question.
Well, I didn't I just said what you felt about the word audience, because two things. One, I was talking earlier about what's the point of it for me of writing and so on, and I think I sort of touched on the first sense for me, which is it's like building a staircase or renovating a house. There's a process that's happening in my body and my psyche, and the writing is just a sort of externalization of some process that allows it to happen, because I'm acting it out externally. It's happening internally. So that's number one. And I realize that can extend to writing, working, perfecting a piece. I'm actually getting my own thoughts in order, which has a deeper level of sort of integrating aspects of my unconscious being, if you will, by making them conscious and so on. So it's all this process. That's number one. And number two, which is secondary, but I don't think it's separate, is that if I write a piece or a book or whatever, and people will discover it and they'll read it, and then I will have a potential connection with the person. They might email me, they might come on the podcast, whatever. And through that book, through that work, it's opened a channel for a dialogue with another living soul. And that's what makes life interesting, is new encounters.
I would say I'm not so comfortable with creating a dialogue with another living soul.
Huh.
Though we have through the music, I could count the people on my hand that I would do, you know, that have that. So I certainly wouldn't want to invite that, you know, every time I play a show. I had the experience, it doesn't happen much in the US because it seems like people don't really care about lyrics that much or not, you know. But when I played in Switzerland, you know, I would take a break and half a dozen people would come and talk about the lyrics and what the lyrics mean and stuff.
Mm.
Maybe it's an analytical country or it was just an analytical crowd. But it was very interesting because it never happens to me here. But there was, you know, I played like, you know, I did a little tour, a number of shows, and it happened time and time again. So you said this, and what do you think about this?
Right.
You know, which I found kind of interesting, but it wasn't necessarily my point. In terms of audience, I feel like, you know, you brought it up in Paper Tiger, your audience was gone by the time it was done.
Yeah.
And yet you sent, I think, in the way it answered the question, and that's how I feel, like, you know, the audience, I guess in your case, the audience demanded the writing, demanded it, so maybe their job is done at that point.
Whose job?
The audience. That it existed. That you wrote because you had to tell a story to someone.
Yeah.
That, I mean, that's what you claim. You know, you said, you know, you had it.
It was like the dialogue. Reminds me actually of that. Did you ever see that movie Five Easy Pieces?
No.
Okay, at the end of it, Jack Nicholson goes to visit his father, who's had a stroke, and his father can't even speak anymore. And Jack Nicholson's character, Bobby Dupre, says to him, the irony is, if you could talk now, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Right.
Because their relationship was so fucked that the only way he's able to talk to his father is now that his father can't speak. And probably vice versa, his father probably wouldn't have listened if he wasn't paralyzed by a stroke. So it's a bit like that with Paper Tiger, that I wrote the dialogue that I needed to have with my brother. The only way I could have it was essentially with him not in the room. and then it was kind of mirrored precisely by the fact that he died while it was in the mail. Like it was somehow some intuition I had that he just would not be able to hear this, and in a certain sense I wouldn't be able to say it while he was alive. Anyway, that's a bit of a digression.
With that emphatic nature of that is what's interesting about it. I guess every once in a while you have that clear sense, like you know your audience, so you know who you're talking to. Other times it's more vague, it's just a...
Yeah, well, the irony, and maybe we're getting to something, because the irony or the poignancy there is that part of what inspired me to write Paper Tag was to realize that everything I wrote was to my brother, because I had internalized him as this critic, this ever-present critic.
Right.
Right, in my mind, telling me I was getting it wrong, or disbelieving, or mocking, or scorning. And that realization that I had this internal voice, this internal audience, an unreceptive audience, no less, was what it made me aware of the need to write that book. That there was something going on between my brother and I, and I needed to resolve it. And so that's an interesting thing that you pointed out, like, that was a very emphatically written work that was ultra aware of the audience that I was addressing. But it was also the way I became aware of that I was always addressing this imaginary audience, which was my brother.
Right, and I think sometimes if you're writing over, if you were to say, well, I wrote my book and I don't need to write any more books, that as audience would answer the question. But if you write over a long period of time, sometimes it won't be so emphatic. Sometimes it won't be just your brother. You start to see a larger picture. I don't have to write any more books for my brother. Maybe I will. You might get up tomorrow and be like, hey, I'll write a book. That was fun. I'll write another book for my brother. I'll write a trilogy,
Well, I got my father. My father and my grandfather was, the last book I wrote was to them. So right. I got a bunch of ancestors to get through, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, there's that in a practical sense, but you might also say, well, I don't need it. Or how you choose, almost like setting up a kind of a game or that part of that we talked about structure of the album. You could also set the game as like, I have to be aware of who I'm writing to. Or I want to change it, or I want to, I have to say, in terms of that, I don't know that I thought about who I definitely, when I first was writing songs, that when we talked about Lords of Howling or that teacher, I definitely had that same thing. This is the person who's going to listen, who's going to be critical. But when that ended, the first part is, well, I don't know. Now I don't know who I'm writing. You have that sense of loss. You're like, I don't know who I'm writing to, because as bad as that was, or as limited as that was, at least was something. It was something emphatic. It was strong and emphatic. But then, so I have to think of, one song on the record was a request for a wedding. A friend called me up. He said, will you be my best man and sing a song to me at my wedding? And so that's one of them. So it had it was like a commission almost.
Right. Which song is that?
That's Hey, Here Comes the Light.
That was the one I put on the podcast, I think. Isn't that the short song on the album?
Yeah, little kind of with a little fanfare trumpets at the beginning. That was something that almost hit the cutting room floor. At one point, it was like, get rid of the... It was like, like a kid's little afternoon kid's special, with the little trumpets. You expect kid to come out.
Funny enough, that was what my wife said about a song, because we were just listening to it. I'm 90% it is the same song, I hope so, otherwise we're going to have to edit this. that it sounded like a show tune, and even she was saying she could even imagine it with like an animated kids show.
Yes, that's probably the one.
It must be the one.
But it's alright to be wrong about that.
You wouldn't want all the songs to fit that description, I don't think.
No, in fact, nobody wanted that. And, it's like, I have to say this because I also thought we would definitely discuss, just because the nature, like Jesus said or whatever, when we talked about it earlier, it was like, I was really uncomfortable with that language. I really didn't want to have the word Jesus in a song. And it was almost going to be first because I thought, that long intro would be a great way to start an album. But then I just kept saying to myself, I just cannot start an album with the word Jesus. You know, mm-hmm. can't have that be the first word.
Mm-hmm.
And I could have, maybe I could have got over it and jumped that hurdle. And I love it being the end of the side. I like it drifting. You know, that's kind of the end of the side of an album is where you've already kind of fallen asleep. You know, the album's done its job. You know, you're on the couch, you're listening to an album, you're like, did I fall asleep?
Uh-huh. And
that song is made for that. And
right.
But it, also that Fanfare of the Trumpet, it was like, do we really want to, we don't want to do a song like this. But, it, you know, it fit, it served its purpose, and it was integral to that song, and it was fine.
Ah, so the self-image has to get thrown
exactly,
off the
exactly.
ship as well, yeah.
Even if we don't know what our self-image is, we do it by negation.
We think we know what it's not.
Mr. Rogers' kids, when it gets in the fairy tale land, that kind of thing. So maybe we are.
So if you were very averse to singing about Jesus, then how was it that you ended up doing so?
Because that song, you know, when I was writing it, I really, you know, I tried like put another couple, switch it out, like put another name in that, you know, had two syllables, like Einstein or
really?
Newtag, I think. Yeah. I tried, you know, I just tried anything. I just like, please.
Oh, wow.
And it was, you know, it's not like it's that bad, and it's kind of, you know, what it is, but it was just not, it wasn't something I had studied. It was just all quickly kind of came out in that fairy tale way, and it wasn't really, I kind of think the first, you know, it was kind of a line. Maybe it kind of came out of some kind of memory from going to church as a kid or whatever, you know. I have a pretty limited literary connection to that. You know, I have a lot more memory of going to Mass and seeing all those things, but not anything I really wanted to talk about.
So you don't read the Gospel regularly?
No,
then?
Never.
No. It's been a long time.
I tried
time.
To. You know, I actually tried to, and it was, and I actually got I feel like it's poorly translated.
I just got a new translation, actually, whether it's any better, but it's supposed to be a much more faithful translation by David Hartley Bent, I think his name is. But I haven't read a great deal of it. I had a recent, I don't know how regularly you listen to the podcast, but if you did, then you would be aware of this. I had a recent brush with Christian conversion. I even got baptized, but that was as far as I took it. I knew it was very unlikely that I would actually, you know, join some Orthodox church or anything, because I just couldn't see myself fraternizing with Christians. But I did, there was a period where I thought maybe this is for me, you know, because as difficult, like you and the Jesus song, as much resistance as there is in me, maybe that's the reason to do it, not out of masochism, but yeah, you know, because maybe it'll be the killing blow to my ego. So I came up with various different rationales why it might happen. It didn't happen, and I haven't even finished reading this new version of the Gospel. So I'm not sure what, that's still a work in progress, let's say. But anyway, to bring it back to your song, what was it that compelled you, do you think?
I don't know. I think that I knew it was complete. It didn't compel me from any personal level. Again, I was kind of cringing at a lot of it. And I don't know, you know, usually if, like you said, if you say kill your darlings, you know, that's, maybe that's obvious, but you could also say like toss out the stuff that makes you cringe, or like you said, you know, or go head on into it. I just kind of went head on into it.
Well, as you say, the flip side of killing your darlings would be give birth to the whatever freaks need to be born.
I like that. Yeah. It'll have to be edited to be a cliche, but we can leave it the full, give birth to the freaks, whoever desiring to be born. Well, yeah, exactly. I think that's what that was. Give birth, you know, and I didn't really know, actually, to be honest, if it didn't, when it was first just a little ditty on a guitar, it would have never really made it. It also compelled that larger kind of orchestrated thing, you know, where it just goes on and on. So, And it's in the context of the chorus, which is kind of my own voice questioning the verse. So I actually, maybe that also allowed me to, which is something I hadn't really done before, was write something that I could then question question it as an outsider in the chorus.
Mm. Oh, so there's a dialogue.
Comes around, I put my own voice in and saying, you know, the answer is no good.
Okay, and that's not the dialogue between Jesus and Mary.
No, the third line is my own. So
there's Jesus and Mary having a dialogue, and then there's this shadowy presence or chorus that's actually interjecting and saying, I disagree with both of you.
Yeah.
Right? You shouldn't even be having this conversation in my head.
Yeah, well, it was more on paper. I didn't really feel it. I didn't feel it in my head so much as on paper. Like, but it was, you know, maybe it was expressing something. I think capable of, you know, very subsumed dialogue, you know, things that are not even acknowledged. Although, you know, I haven't really discussed it until here, right now.
Mm.
Saved it for this conversation.
So. Mm. All right, so
like I said, it doesn't come up. It doesn't come up, you know.
Generally,
where someone asks you about the lyric, well, what, you know, and I don't prepare the answer. I haven't prepared the answer.
Yeah, well, you said earlier you're not self-aware enough to express yourself, which was a very interesting line, because it suggests that one only become, or you at least, but I would agree for myself, one only becomes self-aware by expressing oneself. One doesn't figure out what one wants to express and then express it. One just expresses stuff and then notices, oh, so that's what
that
that's what I had in me. So then in this case you had a Jesus and a Mary within you, that somehow the context of this project demanded that you express,
right?
And I feel as though you kind of dodged that question, perhaps necessarily, but like, what was it that made it necessary? And it brings us back maybe to the when we were originally talking about the context that escort mission, this is your mission, right? To escort something into form, that created this context. Yeah,
escort something into form, for sure. And I think going back to, I don't know if it's the writer or the audience or killing your darlings, it's like, I didn't really have to have any pride in it. I didn't really have to have any feeling of success in it, but I just had to feel its inevitability, right?
Yeah.
And and maybe that was a lesson for me there too, because escorting, bring it into form. And not have a sense that it was, that I had my stamp of approval on it because I wrote it. I don't know, because I think my issues in terms of especially the cringe and cringeworthy nature of Jesus is just how much dialogue and destruction that whole myth, you know, creates on a daily basis.
Sure, of course, but
and so it's very like different. You know, you bring it up, and that's why the Mary part of it was always, if you look at the language, is always trying to negate. It's trying to negate the scripture, so to speak, or not necessarily negate it, but absorb it into like a dark space, absorb it you take one line, which is language, and then you try to create the, even though you're using words, the other one is a kind of a vacuum language. Yeah, kind of a yin yang.
Yin and yang, yeah, I should say.
Yin in the sense of not, you know, where you don't get to describe it, where you don't get to see it, where you don't. Because that would be the descriptors is the yang, the ownership.
And that's what's being absorbed by the receptacle of the female.
Yeah.
Well, that's probably theologically correct. I hate to break it to you, but I suspect that
trying to invent anything. I was just trying to get it done. I was just like, again, I was just, you know, chiseling away in the coal mine. That gets some coal mine stuff there.
You have a daughter, no?
Two.
too. Yeah. So the reason I asked or to be reminded was that your comment about Christianity and your aversion or your cringe about it made me think of that, the thing people say, oh, I can't bring a child into this world because of the state of the world. And I always felt that that was a contradictory statement, because what is going to transform this world if not bringing new life into it? You're having the courage to face, you know, the reality of this world and still affirm life, let's say. I don't want to get too poetic, but that seems to me what maybe you're wrestling with, but what I would be wrestling with about this then is that the very fact that Jesus has become associated with so much destruction certainly invites, but almost commands that somebody somewhere restore something beautiful to that.
Correct.
Whatever it is.
Yeah, and that's kind of that. So there's that kind of story where, as you create something, you know, its opposite is created. Where you're trying to, like, I kind of think, you know, that someone like backing quietly out of like a bar fight.
Yeah.
poetically backing out, saying, just, you know, it's very sparse on words, just be like, I'm going to try to say this, I'm going to try not to make anything worse.
Yeah
I think would be, yeah, so interesting to create something where you're trying to create as little as possible.
It's like a spark in a cinder box. Yeah, so the bar that you're backing out of is already, there's already a bar fight going on, and there's fists flying every which way, right? So that makes it, on the one hand, much easier to get punched, but it also makes it easier to back away, because no one's particularly targeting you.
That's true. Right, it's the ego that thinks you're seen or even noticed.
And it's occurring to me, maybe it's a reach, but you're saying your previous incarnation with the Lords of Howling was this mission to fight evil. Well, so then you would have this old mindset of the Armageddon, and if you invoke the name of Jesus, it's going to be the Book of Revelation. Jesus is going to be Judgment Day, and the storm and drang of, you know, the dark side of Christianity. But actually, if you do refer to the gospel, there's none of that in there. It is peace and love. So you can't really blame Jesus or Mary for, you know, what a bunch of misinterpretations have led to.
Right. If you would say, I mean, in an abstract way, to say anything created is not necessary. If you create, are you responsible for the bar fight? You know, if you sing a song, are you responsible for the bar fighting?
Right, no, yeah. It's the guy serving the beer.
Because I think now I'm real, yeah, there are people that are spoiling for a fight.
Yeah, exactly.
And I feel neither, like, you know, in joining them or saving them, or, you know, in that sense.
So how is it for you to sing that song then? No, I guess maybe you haven't done it live.
You do. I love singing it. I just can't, you know, think about it too much. It's interesting.
Yeah.
I do love it, singing it. And I'm glad it's made its way on there. You know, it's just, it was an important one for me. But again, and then I think musically, it absorbs itself into its music too. You know, it ends with going laws for four or five minutes long.
Okay, so the music absorbs the lyrics, you mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Just as what the song is about, in some sense. Yeah.
That's why I had it that. Gave it that kind of wholeness. I think there was a wholeness to that, in that sense.
So you think that you're acclimatizing yourself to something that you were previously antipathetic to, or, like you say, it made you cringe and
possibly.
Get through it, but now it's not making you cringe so much.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's how you do it, right? I think that's how that. I think that's the process. And if you ask, well, what? Well, you earlier where you asked, what do you get from it? There's that, you know. Because at first I was said, oh, I said it was all ephemeral, just like, you know, a day and a night. But now it's like, but you're, you end up changed. Hmm. Definitely end up changed from the process. Hmm. I would say absolutely.
And more open, perhaps softer, more, I don't know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but.
Yeah, or even put that it needs, I mean, to be changed, I guess. I guess you can analyze it if you want. I was just say, I mean, sometimes you're just happy to be changed. You know, you feel like, oh, I'm a changed man.
I have the tendency to unanalyze, and I'm also analyzing my tendency to analyze and the possibility it will, you know, minimize the gains if I take them up into my head. And, you know, so with a thrift store, I notice it's allowing me to become more open, more flexible, more expansive, more compassionate, warmer, and all of this just because it's a constant process of surrendering that cringe reflex or that recoil reflex to things that I find antipathetic, let's say, it's very rewarding in that regard. Like the thing about resist not evil, I don't want to really be on my guard about anything that I don't need to be on my guard about, especially not human beings.
Right. And I think if you can manage to like introduce yourself to that, then that becomes your kind of work. I'm not work, but I'm structure or whatever, you know, that's how you want to live. And that's the kind of a beautiful thing. I'll introduce cringeworthy. I like that phrase. I'll have to listen to this back.
Well, you know, Jesus, he hung out with the tax collectors and the prostitutes and the lepers. So he was all about inhibiting the cringe reflex.
Right. And it's like Van Gogh painting, you know, people taking different subject matters that weren't used before, you know, or writing a book about whaling or whatever. There's something of that, yeah, where you, I never thought of it in the same way, but it's kind of true. It's like, this subject matter is beneath me, or this subject, you know, this is not the subject matter that I write about. This is not what I write about, you know.
Right.
Yeah, that kind of voice that says that, you know. So
but I that
important things.
And that became your favorite song.
Yeah, I hate to play. That one came really special to me, I'll say that. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I like them all. I don't, it's whatever.
But. Yeah, I know. It's like children, yeah? You don't want to leave any out.
No, but by the fact that it was only eight, it was easy to like them all. There was certainly no room for songs that weren't loved, for sure.
Well, there's the pregnant pause that lets us know that we're probably,
it
covered all the bases, huh?
End of round one. You know, the side.
No, this is round two, I think.
Okay. Yeah, that's right.
This is side two.
I hear a voice that's not my own that tells me to jump into the sea. I'm tired of listening to these words, I know they aren't meant for me. I know they aren't meant for me.
I'll tell you something. I've been typing letters with each of the records on my typewriter, and I write a letter. This is my epilogue. Otherwise, we'll start again. But I was typing. Letters to everyone, and I put it with the record and I send it, and that process feels really good, sort of an invisible audience but also that intended audience. But the other night I had a dream, and I was typing the letters to people that I was sending with the records, but in the dream I said to myself, oh, I forgot to put the drip irrigation in with the letters. You know, that with that little drip that you put in the garden, little tubes, we have them here.
Do they spray or no?
Yeah, you bury them in the earth and around the seeds, and they just drip slowly.
Okay.
But that was this dream, and it was a very short little dream. But I woke up and I was like, oh, I had sent the letter off, but I had forgot to put the drip irrigation in it. The dream was on that level where that made sense. And it
yeah,
was,
of course. But you didn't analyze it.
Exactly. But now, then when I woke up, it was just something very charming.
It's very charming.
Part of sending the record was sending the little letter to you.
These words are yours. From when you are born, everything you are told becomes you without your choice. Some point they become the family of